Mr. K Super Show, a podcast for the discerning music and pop culture geek, hosted by Chris Karam. Welcome to Mr. K Super Show. I'm Chris Karam, aka Chris Karam, and today we're going to be talking about one of my favorite bands, a band that really hit its stride and made its mark in the 80s, and that's primarily what we're going to be discussing, Def Leppard. Yes, folks, the British boys from Sheffield. And to do that, I'm bringing on someone who's more or less an expert in that. He is the creator and host of the Kiss FAQ podcast, Look It's Rock and Roll podcast, and the forthcoming Sick as a Pod, an Aerosmith podcast, which I want to be a part of, hint, hint. He is also the author of several books on Kiss, Aerosmith, and yes, Def Leppard. Julian Gill, welcome back to the show.
Chris, thanks for having me on. It's taken far too long for us to get back together to talk about Def Leppard.
Yeah, I know. And I was so glad Friday when you said, let's just do it. So in the spirit of that, but before we go into it, give me your Def Leppard origin story.
Well, I was living in America by the time I got into Def Leppard. And my origin story is I had a very good friend in Binghamton, New York, who would go around flea markets. He was a big Beatles fan. So it was always going around the flea markets, looking for Beatles stuff. But he turned me on to Pyromania. And I don't know what got him into Pyromania, but he played it for me and I was hooked immediately. And went back from there and discovered the earlier stuff, which resonated with me far more than Pyromania ever did. So that's my origin story.
You know, as for me, Cream magazine published a story in the fall of 1980 called The New Wave of Heavy Metal. And it was a report about all these British bands who were lumped under the umbrella of the new wave of British heavy metal, like Iron Maiden, who also made their debut that year. And I have to do a show on them soon. Def Leppard was one of them. And then, of all places, 16 Magazine had this little blurb about a new band from Sheffield called Def Leppard. And I thought they had a really cool-looking album cover, On Through the Night, cool logo. But I didn't really hear them until High and Dry, 1981, when Bring on the Heartbreak was all over album rock radio. I even saw that somehow managed to see the video, even though we didn't have MTV. And I don't even think MTV had started just yet when High and Dry came out. But anyway, it goes from there, and we'll get into that more as we talk about the albums. Their first album, of course, and you know, you want to talk about an 80s band. This came out literally in 1980. So this decade got off to a great start with this band. And I'm talking about On Through the Night, which came out in America in March of 1980, and it was produced by Tom Allom. Julian.
Tom Allom, who was... He had just finished doing British Steel. So you've got that holy trinity of releases that come out around that time, which he finishes up with Judas Priest. Def Leppard goes in, does their first sessions with him, and then On Through the Night and Iron Maiden's debut come out at the same time. I mean, what a mighty bunch of three albums, even though we're only talking about Def Leppard here. I love On Through the Night. Always do.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of energy on this record, and part of me is wondering, is the track Hello America a sort of calculated way of saying we want to dominate the world, so hey, America, we're in your rearview mirror right now, but in a couple of years, we're going to be leading the charge. I don't know, but Rock Brigade, a lot of energy, nice anthemic song, you know, and there are definite hints of greatness of what's to come.
Yeah, without a doubt. You know, you do get Hello America, which was a really bad song to release in Britain, because that was when they started throwing stones at them immediately, was when that single came out. It was like, well, you're going to leave us.
Yeah, but I love the fact that after the solo, they have that breakdown where it's, I don't know if it's tongue in cheek or a little bit of a, you know, nod and a wink when they do the sort of Beach Boys surf rock kind of homage. I'm guessing it's tongue in cheek because they're saying Hello America, you know, but a fun song. But you're right. Yeah. How foolish was it of them to release that in Britain as a single, especially given how, as I understand it, Julian, sometimes, you know, if you make it in America, unless you're a superstar band, Britain will just say, we don't want to have anything to do with you.
It's a very British aesthetic to start knocking down people as soon as they've made it, whether it's socially or bands. We're very jealous of our bands, and these good Northern boys, working class heroes, having the audacity to put out a song like Hello America when they should have done Rock Brigade. Without a doubt, it had been queued up to be a single in 1979 after the EP had come out, but it got canned, and it's also a better recording, actually. But wrong single choice, but the album's just so full of great songs. I've always loved Rock Brigade. There's something about the riffs. It Could Be You, which is just a chugging along kind of, it belies their youth that they were able to write these sorts of songs at that age and also put in a mature, you know, dual guitar lineup across all the material.
Oh, yeah. And what's interesting is that the title track for this album will not appear until the next album. Julian, you have some depth of knowledge of Def Leppard. Did they write that song for this album and maybe they just couldn't realize it in terms of the production or no? No,
they just realized that it was a pretty damn good title and they better write a song around it by the time that the next album came around. I mean, go figure. It's one of the strange things that it's like Houses of the Holy with Zeppelin.
Or like Sheer Heart Attack with Queen. I mean, that took like maybe two or three albums before they finally put that title track on, of all things, News of the World, which at the time is like, well, that's an interesting title. I didn't realize it was a sort of tongue-in-cheek nod to the British tabloids, but, you know, Queen was always doing things with a wink and a nod, as we both know, especially Mr. Mercury. But yeah, like I said, this album just has a lot of energy. It's cracking. It's just, you know, a really good statement of intent. And Tom Allum, thank you for correcting me on the
property. That's just what I call it. I've got no idea what it is.
No, you know, it probably is. I mean, sometimes with names that are not American, you know, we tend to default to a certain way of pronouncing things. You're probably right. I mean, I'm sure if you walked up to me and say Allum, you know, or something like that, who knows?
Now, let's not ignore the B-side to Hello America, Good Morning Freedom, which should have been on the album in place of Hello America.
I probably didn't hear that song until maybe two or three years ago when that early years box set came out, you know, that focused on Through the Night and High and Dry, which is a great box set, by the way, if you're a hardcore Def Leppard fan. There's just so, there's such a wealth of material in it, well worth the price. It's what's great about it is that it's not an overpriced box where you're like, should I buy this? I'm like, okay, I'm in. But yeah, you're right. Yeah.
And the live album on it, which was recorded during that first British tour, I mean, that was written about in the press at the time that they'd recorded a show for, you know, release. And then it doesn't come out until, you know, 40 years later. It's amazing. That's the sort of box set that's a real hit in my mind.
Well, Def Leppard is unlike Kiss. They got on the bat right away about releasing these archival box sets and pushing them out there every couple of years or so. Whereas it took Kiss like, oh, wait a minute, everybody else is doing it, we should start doing it. But, you know, enough about Off the Soundboard and you know, the kind of overpriced box sets. Yeah, definitely. These guys, a lot of energy, a lot of that British determination. And obviously they had their sights set on being a sensation. They were not going to be content to just, you know, be a British thing or a European thing. And that's going to really yield results one or two albums down the line, three albums down the line for sure. So unless you have anything else to say about On Through the Night, Julian.
No, let's move on.
Let us move on to an album that's a very important album in Def Leppard's chronology. And I'm talking about their second album, 1981's High and Dry. This album was released July 6, 1981. And most importantly, this is the beginning of a very fruitful relationship with Robert John Mutt Lange, who, in my estimation, is going to be to Def Leppard what George Martin was to the Beatles or Jack Douglas was to Aerosmith. Julian, your thoughts on High and Dry?
Well, if On Through the Night was Def Leppard as a mewling baby, then High and Dry is Def Leppard as a screaming toddler. They've learned how to walk, and now they're learning how to scream, and they're doing all their screaming with the guitars. High and Dry is actually in my pantheon of all-time favorite albums, period. If I was to have music put in my coffin when I'm planted, this would be one of the albums that I want in my CD changer for eternity. It is that good. It is that powerful. It is impossible for me to listen to this album without grabbing my guitar and playing along to it with the riffing. It is just an incredibly well-crafted piece of metal, which proves that what this band became was firmly fixed in 1981 and then diluted from that point onwards.
That's an excellent summation, because I see this album as the beginning of one era and the end of another era. This is obviously the beginning of the Mutt Lang era, and he's going to help Def Leppard be all that they can be. He's going to help them not only find their true sound, but he's going to lead them to commercial heights that I'm sure even they couldn't have imagined. And this album, like I said, this was finally Def Leppard getting on AOR radio, Album Oriented Rock, as it was known back then in the States. Despite having no MTV or, you know, not being around as such, I somehow caught the video and I thought, these guys are pretty cool. And that's really the only song I remember hearing from this back then. If they had any other singles, I don't think the rock stations were playing them. But yeah, this may be my favorite Def Leppard album of all time. If not, it's a close second. I'm not sure. It may be the next one. But at any rate, great album. They are really finding their sound. They're honing in on what makes them Def Leppard. And I say the end of an era because this is obviously the last album with Pete Willis as a full member. And it's kind of the last pure hard rock heavy metal album that they will do, because the next album is going to begin a transition to, you know, like you said, they're a toddler. They're going to become grade school infants joining the track team on the next album. They're going to go from being the $1 million man to the $6 million man. But I mean, you know, the title track, the title track, High and Dry, Saturday Night, I just can't help but rock out when I hear that song. I had that playing a little while ago, and like, this song still gives me that, you know, the hairs on my arm rising. I still want to like air guitar and you know, do air drumming. Killer, killer song. Switch 625, which is what Bringing on the Heartbreak segues into. Brilliant, brilliant.
I love playing that. That's my guitar jam. That is my guitar jam. I love playing that. That's one of the few songs. I'm not a very good guitar player. I do it purely for giggles, but that I can do the solo on and that I care about playing. But the whole album is just, it was the high point. It was the original Def Leppard as far as they could go before that interference in their development became, you know, tantamount to changing their direction. You know, that they were an asteroid flying through the universe on this album, and then a little guided missile called Mutt Lang knocks them off course.
You're right. It's kind of like the whole Mutt Lang thing is like a blessing and a curse in the same, you know, obviously this album, the production is better. It's a little more crafted, but as we all know, Mutt Lang is a perfectionist who takes 2 weeks to record, you know, 1 millisecond of a song. And that's not much of an exaggeration based on what I've read about Mutt Lang. And I think that can work to the detriment when you have to do something 87 times. I mean, how can you possibly play with any conviction or passion if you're just doing the same riff? But you can't argue with the results. This album is just near perfect. It's a killer, and it really put them on course. Like I said, it got them on the radio in the States. It gave them a presence. And as good as this record was and as successful as it was, I think it was platinum in the States, if I'm not mistaken, within, you know, a reasonable time of its release. It very, very least it had to be gold. Great album. Like you said, I love it to this day, and I don't have too much else to say about it. I mean, there's just, you can only rave about something so many times, Julian.
No, but it was essentially the band's rocks album, you know, where Aerosmith took 4 albums to hit that stride. Def Leppard did it in 2. It's like Zeppelin 4, them completely hitting that plateau. So where did they have to go from there? Would they have had a long career if they had just continued doing this sort of material? Or would they have become a second-rate AC/DC?
Well, we're going to find out. 2 scant years later, on January 20th, 1983, the third album, Pyromania, is released. This is the point in the timeline where they go supernova. This is to me is a real transitional album. We're getting more keyboards. The pop side of things is becoming more and more present. This album came out. I was a junior in high school, and this is when I finally jumped on board and said, "Okay, I got to get this album." And in short order, I got the other two. This was the album. If you were a heavy metal fan, hard rock fan, whatever, you had to have this album. You couldn't, you know. I was not even remotely resembling a cool kid, but I would have felt even more uncool if I didn't own this album. And needless to say, it's great. But Julian, I'll let you rattle on a little bit about it.
I think what set me up to enjoy this album as much as I did in 1983 was I had come in from listening to Quiet Riot, which, you know, took advantage of the door that Def Leppard broke down. And then I found Def Leppard. So I kind of flipped things around just from my personal experience of where each one of those bands entered. And what I found with this album was I'd liked the refinements at the time of it somewhat softened that heavy metal into powerful hard rock. So it took a step back from kind of the thrashy abrasiveness that is what I love most about High and Dry, but also dialed it back to make it more accessible, more commercial, more radio friendly before I ever knew the importance of those within the industry context. So as a pure consumer from an ignorant point of view, I liked the sounds of it. Now, when I was listening to it yesterday, I was like, oh shit, there's just too many keyboards here. That was just a photograph. I was like, keyboards, you know, this one has not aged well for me, because it's going to be strange as this conversation goes on, because you're going to be squinting at me going, what the hell, you know, for the stuff that I like and the stuff that doesn't. This is one of my least favorite Def Leppard albums at this point, and has not gone into very regular play rotation. So maybe I reverted to my British self, because this album didn't break there either.
Wow. It was just the opposite, you know, you were in the States by this point, right? As you said. Yeah. Well, in my neck of the woods, New England, I mean, if you were into heavy metal, you had to have this album. And I listened to it, I'm like, yeah, I like this. Yeah, the keyboard aspect was definitely pronounced, but I didn't own High and Dry by this point, by the way, or the first album. I would get those soon after. This is when I kind of like it really jumped on the bandwagon. So I kind of listened to it more with a less preconceived notion of what Def Leppard sounded like based on the first two records. So I just jumped in and thought, this is great. I mean, I didn't even have MTV on my cable system at that point, but somehow I managed to see those videos all the time through other means, like USA Night Flight, or HBO would sometimes run music videos between movies to kill time, because they didn't have commercials per se. But yeah, these guys looked cool, you know, Joe Elliott and the British, the Union Jack shirt and the videos, Rock of Ages, you know, Foolin'. I mean, and the album tracks I love too, Too Late for Love, Die Hard, The Hunter. One thing, and you might be able to confirm this, Julian, I have heard, it could be just a rumor, that even as early as this album, Rick Allen had been replaced by a drum machine.
Rick Allen, it is a drum machine on this album. That's part of the problem I have with it now from a technical point of view, is that it does not sound like an organic drummer. So I listen to the soundboards from this tour, and I much prefer it because it's really Rick drumming. Yeah. And he was a fantastic drummer in both of his lives. Two Arms and after the accident, absolutely amazing drummer. But back when he was a traditional drummer, he was just batting well above his level for his age, when you think of how young he was. So to have replaced him with sampled sounds, sequenced in as he played, but to get that perfection that Mutt wanted out of it, is how I believe the story goes. And then layered on the keyboards and Phil solos, you've got three factors that make me don't like this album. Because Phil, I love. I absolutely love Phil in Girl. In Girl, I like him. But he changes the dynamic sonically so much from this point out, that I actually prefer a drunk, angry Pete Willis.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I'm glad you brought that up, because obviously this is the album where Phil Collin makes his debut. What's interesting, though, is even though they kicked Pete Willis out, they kept his guitar tracks. And in fact, very prominently on the rear of the album, it says all guitar, you know, backing tracks by Pete Willis. Now, I think that speaks to some character, because other bands would have just buried that credit in the liner notes on the inner sleeve, like maybe at the very end in tiny print. Oh yeah, people, this is on this. So they obviously, even though he wasn't getting along with the band, I guess he had alcohol problems. Kind of ironic getting kicked out of Def Leppard for that, given what we know and what we'll find out later. But they kept his tracks. And another thing I want to mention about the making of this album, and you can might be able to confirm this or not, Thomas Dolby, Mr. You know, Science, is credited
with the keyboard.
Yep. But I've also heard on Yes forums that Tony Kaye, the original keyboardist from Yes, also did some uncredited keyboard work on this.
I've never heard that one.
Yeah, yeah. It's mainly in Yes circles, but it's never really been confirmed. Tony Kaye has never been asked about it, or at least not that I know of.
You know what? And anything is possible with these situations. When you're replacing your drummer wholesale with a drum machine, you've got obviously a keyboard player who couldn't be credited for legal reasons. I believe it was a different record label or something to that effect.
That might have been it too. Yeah.
But they also went out of their way to keep Pete Willis's credits. Pete Willis made a bank on that, and that's what set him up for life, in essence, was the success of that album, even though he'd left the band because he was no longer able to be functional. So yeah, his rhythm work stays, but it doesn't exactly have any of his screaming leads left in it. And you know, again, just as a side, that money helped him buy a lot of property in Sheffield, and he was my sister's landlord.
Oh, that's
when she was at Sheffield University, and she used to have to call Pete Willis up to come over and fix her clogged up sink.
That's awesome.
She'd just say, "There's this tiny little guy under the sink fixing it." You know,
small world. You know, just to go off on a sort of related tangent, after this Mutt Lange produced "Heartbeat City" by the Cars, there was a cover story in Rolling Stone in the summer of 1984 where they talked about the making of Heartbeat City, and the drummer, David Robinson, was not happy with the fact that he had to sample his own drum hits and learn how to program the drum machine because Mutt Lange wanted perfection. Yep. So that really kind of ties into what you were saying about, you know.
But it was also fortuitous training for Rick to a certain extent.
Yes.
With actually, the advent or becoming more familiar with the utilization of that technology before he ever had the accident, it, I think, at least opened his mind to the possibilities after the accident of what he could do. And I don't think maybe he would have had that had he not had the experience with Pyromania. So I think it certainly plays a part in their future.
Absolutely. And obviously, like I said, this puts them on the map in America. This really sets the stage for the next album. But we have a little interlude in 1984. The guys have been on the road for about a year, and they didn't have a new album to come out in 1984. So very cleverly, Polygram re-releases High and Dry with a couple of bonus tracks added on. Bringing on the Heartbreak remix, which, I'm sorry, Julian, adding synthesizer to a song doesn't make it any better. It just was like, that's it. Gave them an excuse to make a video for MTV, and it was smart marketing, but I much preferred the B-side, the Me and My Wine remix, which has a hilarious music video. We didn't know at the time about The Young Ones. It hadn't made its way over here yet, but as I understand it, that's basically a homage parody of The Young Ones. You can probably tell me about
yes.
that.
Yes. No, it's a complete homage to a dysfunctional, basically household of completely different characters. And again, if you've seen the video, just go out and watch some Young Ones. I don't want to even color your opinions of it. And it's just a shame that some of those actors are no longer with us.
Well, you know, I saw the video and I didn't know about the image. So I just saw it as a fun, goofy video. And I'm like, hey, this is kind of cool. Instead of them doing this big epic video where they're posing dramatically, they're just goofing around in an apartment. So what the hell? You know, it's like it's a lot of fun. And that's all I needed back then. And, you know, a few years later, I saw The Young Ones, and then, you know, saw it again. I'm like, oh, OK, I see the connection now. But, you know, in the States, I don't think we got The Young Ones till 87 or 88 on MTV. So we were oblivious to that Coronation Street, because that caused another controversy with Queen's I Want to Break Free video, which I just saw as, oh, they're wearing drag. This is funny. This is cute. Meanwhile, the Nervous Nellies and the Bible Belt are protesting it off the air because, oh, my God, a bunch of men in drag, you know, with Freddie Mercury obviously having obviously fake boobs and a mustache. Seriously.
Never bothered me. But then again, I used to bop along to Karma Chameleon. So,
yeah. I mean, I wasn't even aware of that at the time, because I watched the video on MTV and just thought, oh, it's funny. I didn't realize it was a homage to a British show. It was just, they were in drag. They looked hilarious. It was a good song. And but you know, I'd like to say that we've gotten a lot less uptight about that. But as you know, we haven't, and that's about as far as I want to go with that. Now, before we get to the next album, a very cataclysmic event happens in the Def Leppard chronology, as we both know. On December 31st, 1984, Rick Allen is involved in a almost fatal car crash where his, Julian, can you tell me which arm it is? I always forget. We're not making fun of what happened here, folks.
I believe it's his left arm.
Okay, Rick Allen's left arm gets ripped off in a really horrible car accident. He flips over. They try to reattach it. It doesn't take. So Rick Allen is now faced with the fact that his career in Def Leppard, and just as a drummer per se, could very well be over. But this is where the happy ending comes in. It's not. Rick gets with an electronic drum manufacturer, and they develop a set where he can control with his left foot the stuff that he would have done with his left arm or, you know, whatever. And it takes a while, but to the guys in Def Leppard's credit, they didn't just say, sorry, mate, you know, we can't use you anymore. You're a one-armed guy. They, as Joe Elliott put it on Behind the Music, we took the cowards way out. He was going to have to tell us that he couldn't be in the band anymore. We weren't going to let him go. Obviously, he works on it, and they develop it to a point where they do their first live show in 86, I believe, at Donington. Would that be correct, Julian?
No, they did some warm-up dates in Ireland for the Monsters of Rock tour. The first date was in County Cork.
Well, you know, anyway, they bring a backup drummer, but as the story goes, the backup drummer missed his flight and actually didn't show up till maybe halfway through the set, leaving a petrified Rick Allen to go on for the first time in front of a live audience with, you know, just having that one arm and using the electronic kit. But apparently it was flawless. They played great. He got a standing O and things go on. But in the midst of all this, Def Leppard is trying to make the sequel to Pyromania, and they are not having a good time of it, Julian. Obviously, they try with Jim Steinman. What do you know about the Jim Steinman sessions?
That it was a nightmare, that they were completely incompatible with him. And Jim, at that point, wasn't at his best either. Jim was an absolutely amazing creator, without a doubt, but it was cheese and chalk. Was the completely wrong combination. I guess the Americans would say oil and water.
Cheese. Yeah, we don't eat cheese and chalk in this country, you know.
So it didn't work out, but I think it was important that it bought Rick time as well.
Yes.
You know, to deal with the emotional trauma of the accident and losing a limb and having a life-changing event like that. And the band's also suffering at the same time. So whether one threw off the other or it was all part of the same problem. I mean, we go back to the education thing that I kind of talked about with the first two albums. Well, Pyromania was the album where they're in high school. And then they go to college for the next one. But, you know, they did several shows in Ireland, primarily with Jeff Rich, who had just joined Status Quo as drummer, sitting in the wings. And as you have already recounted the story of him arriving late to a gig, they hadn't used him. You know, he'd been there as a safety net, which is important to differentiate. But Rick did have to go on without a safety net, you know, in front of a paying audience. And then they did, you know, two shows later, they did Donington. I was waiting for reports out of that show to see how Rick had done and that Def Leppard was back. That whole summer was one of excitement that Def Leppard, mighty Def Leppard, had survived this traumatic experience. We're back on the stage. Now, were they going to be legitimate Def Leppard or not? We didn't know. It was such a fun time to be a music fan.
Oh, yeah. Now, obviously, the attempt with Jim Steinman fails. So they decide to go it alone, producing the album with their engineer, Nigel Green. That doesn't work either, or it you know, they only get so far with it. Finally, Mutt Lang becomes available. He steps back into the picture, and then finally the recording proper for the next album gets in earnest. 1987 comes, and this is August. Let's see, the release date is August 3rd. Now, back in the 80s, Julian, as you know, bands would put out an album every 1 or 2 years. To have an album like Pyromania that's so huge and then have a 4-year gap, especially where you've got the drummer losing his arm and all this, you know, behind the scenes drama, there was a lot of anticipation and expectation for this album. What are your thoughts on Hysteria?
It's my second favorite album in the whole catalog. And you're probably going, wait, you just bashed on Pyromania because of the techno wizardry and some of the tricksy messing around with the sonics of the album. Well, that's the difference between a rock album that has been tweaked and an album that has been created around the concept from the get-go. So when Mutt comes back in, he's fully aware of the new reality facing all of the band, not just Rick, but he fully knows and is starting from the ground up with them, working with that fundamental base of Rick. The drums are foundational to any recording. That's your first layer right there. So it's designed around that. And no wonder he agonized on the notes, you know, and put them through absolute hell. Because when you compare the material that predates him with the material that becomes the album, it is just so perfectly crafted from start to finish. They've created a heavy metal or a hard rock. Let's not use heavy metal when describing that band. They'll get upset. But a hard rock thriller with every song could be a potential hit. And that songcraft, that attention to detail in the recording comes through and through and through. I could play this album. It takes me back to a very happy place. I was coming back from Singapore that summer when it came out. I had this in my Walkman. It just, I mean, the summer of 87, just musically, was absolutely amazing. But this was the high point. This is what I'd waited for 4 years to hear. This is a one where every single song was fantastic and just amazing.
You know, my reaction is the polar opposite of yours. I heard this and I'm like, what the hell is this? This was so different from what I was expecting, which I basically was probably expecting Son of Pyromania. Maybe a little bit of a progression. This was such a leap forward that initially I was like, I don't like this album. This is not, it was a grower for me. And then I came to your kind of point of view about it. Maybe not that every song could be a potential single, but it had a lot of great songs. You know, and conversely, in America, they released Women as the first single, which hit with a resounding thud. It was not a hit. MTV, it was like, this album was almost stillborn. It was almost dead in the water until maybe almost a year later when Pour Some Sugar hit. And that finally, that kind of unblocked it. And then it was, you know, it was just a go from there. And I'll tell you one thing I remember distinctly. That was a song that a lot of strippers danced to. You know, I may have known some people who frequented strip clubs back then, you know, possibly me. But it just, that was cute. And then once that happened, forget it. It was all over MTV, seven singles. I mean, and I listen to it now. It's a masterpiece. It's a great album, even though at one point I was sick of it because of the oversaturation between MTV and the radio. But I listen to it now. It's like, this is a exquisitely crafted record. It's not my favorite by them. But it's definitely an album where they just reached a plateau creatively. But yeah, initially I was like, what the hell is this? This is this new sound. It's like bigger than life. It's not Pyromania 2.
No, and I have never tired of this album. And maybe I was set up in a good place musically to really appreciate it. In earlier 1987, the self-titled Whitesnake album came out, and that for them was transformational from, you know, I'd gotten into them when they were a blues rock boogie band. And that was a completely different beast, but in terms of softening that sonic palette into more radio accessible, Motley Crue's Girls, Girls, Girls came out, same situation.
Aerosmith, with that, Current Vacation, which we talked about in our last podcast.
That comes out, you know. So also in 87, you know, I don't remember where it fits in sequence wise. In Excess, Kick.
Yeah, another great album. Not a, you know, so metal album, but
a lot of these albums were changing the dynamics of what hard rock was. And what Hysteria did for me was stretch those boundaries within my mind about what was acceptable for a rock band to be doing. So it made me reapproach how I consume music. I want a super deluxe of this album so badly, and they've not done it right yet. Really? For all the releases that they have done. Because they have not put in any of the 1984-85 demos or recordings that they did. So you cannot, they've teased it in Ultimate Albums Hysteria or Classic Albums, whatever the TV program was on that, where they twisted knobs a little bit on the original version of Animal. I want to hear these full songs within their original context in order to compare what Rick had recorded before the accident or what they did early on in the sessions with what came later. Because after all that craft work is done, you've got two completely different bands. They go to university and they graduate first class honors with this album. And it really does set them up. What is the likelihood of a band repeating the sort of success that they had with Pyromania with their very next release after a traumatic experience or two, if you include Steinman?
Well, not only that, this album cost so much money to record that if this album hadn't been a blockbuster, their career would have been over. They would have been dumped by the label. They probably, you know, because they had racked up, what, like a $9 million? It was a big money figure.
Millions. Yeah. I think they had to sell 5 million to break even. Something stupid. I don't remember the exact numbers on it. But I think more importantly to me as a Brit, before I moved to America, I grew up in Yorkshire. So I've got a certain amount of affinity with this band on a personal level because of the Yorkshire connection and the north of England. This is the album where they finally broke in England.
Yeah, I was surprised to learn that later on. Because, you know, being in America, we don't, you know, especially back then before the internet, we didn't really know what was going on in Britain. And unless, you know, maybe by the mid-80s, you know, Kerrang started making its way here and we had some sense of what was going on. But we just knew Def Leppard was a great band. They were selling and we weren't really too worried about what was going on. I just think it's amazing that it took them four albums before they finally cracked their home country. You know, it's amazing.
79, if you go back to the music press in Britain in 79, they were gushing over Def Leppard. There was only one way for that direction of support to go, and it couldn't have gone any further down than it did from there.
Yeah, and this album had a good run, almost 2 years. I remember the last video was Rocket, I believe. And you're probably going to hate me for saying this. I think they put out one single and video too many because, honestly, I like Rocket as an album track. I don't think it was single worthy. And although the video is kind of fun because it's a homage to, you know, the glam stuff, Bowie and T-Rex and Slade and all the stuff they grew up with, Queen. I just didn't feel that song. I felt like they were obviously trying to equal Thriller. So they did go for the seventh song. I might have gone with Gods of War, but that might not have been as commercial. I don't know what you think about that.
No, I'm with you on that. I would have gone with Run Riot, something rocking, or maybe even one of the B-sides. I Want to Be Your Hero.
Tear It Down.
Or Tear It Down, for that matter. Again, this was the album that got me, as a collector, really hooked on collecting because of all the B-sides that came out through the lifespan of this album. They're represented well in the deluxe box that was finally released for the album, as incomplete as I accuse it of being. So there's a ton of extended mixes, a ton of additional songs, one song that should not have been done, which is an absolute abomination to all that is holy, Ring of Fire.
Not
Ring of Fire. Ride Into the Sun should never have been re-recorded. Oh. That is morally, ethically, absolutely wrong. Gets me very upset.
A friend of mine who was a Def Leppard fan, as a gift when the first deluxe came out, the two disc version, she's like, "I love this like all the bonus stuff, but I hate Ring of Fire. It's like, it's who's singing it?" I'm like, I think it's meant to be tongue in cheek. It's a little joke. They have one of their crew guys singing it. I don't think it's meant to be taken too seriously.
No, that's Release Me that we're talking about, which was, that was sung by their tour manager, Malvin. Ring of Fire is a song. I love Ring of Fire. That's a song that everyone who's ever had a bad curry knows.
Yeah. So obviously this album cements Def Leppard as a superstar act. They're unstoppable now. Or so we think, because I'll never forget, it was a bitter cold winter night in January of 1991. I'm getting into my car after a day at work. I put on the radio, and the first thing I hear is that Steve Clark had died. I was like, what? I had no idea what was going on. This was before the internet. I had no idea he had been on a hiatus from the band because of his drinking and drugs had gotten really out of control. Julian, where were you when you found out about Steve Clark, and what was your take on the whole thing at the time?
You know, I don't remember where I was at the time. I just remember being devastated because he was the coolest guitarist with the lowest slung guitar you'd ever seen. And when you look back at videos of him performing and on the Historia video or others, he just personified cool, rake thin, but fighting a demon who won for him. His battle against alcoholism and other issues are just so devastating, because for me, it was that, well, that's both of the guitarists gone now. Because Phil, you know, fill-in was a fill-in. And now Steven's gone as well. And I'm like, what is this band going to mean to me going forward without that one guitar anchor to the past? And I was very concerned. I mean, my love of Def Leppard was such that I was, I don't want to say frightened because that sounds pathetic, but I was rather concerned about the future.
Right. And prior to the release of the next album, there were all sorts of rumors going around. In fact, I was somehow led to believe that John Sykes from Blue Murder and Whitesnake had joined the band or was going to join the band, and that he was going to be on the new record. Of course, that proved to be false. So let's jump ahead a year to March 31st, 1992, and Adrenalize. What is very significant, I find, in retrospect, by this point, all the quote-unquote hair metal bands or bands of Def Leppard's ilk were pushed away, pushed aside, where they were off the charts. Kurt Cobain was the new king of rock, the king of grunge. Somehow, despite that, Def Leppard manages to get her album out, and it's a hit. It's the videos are all over MTV. It's not quite as big as Hysteria, but it does pretty well. Julian, what was your take on Adrenalize?
Wasn't a fan initially. Again, I was very worried about where they were going to go after Hysteria. The big joke was, well, we'll have the next album out in less than 4 years, and then look what happens. It's essentially 5 years or four and a half between releases. They lead off with one of the worst singles I've ever heard from that band, Let's Get Rocked, which I did not like on first listen. I find myself much more ambivalent about it these days. I've been guilty of bopping my head along to it, in other words, because you just can't help yourself with this band. They're infectious. They make you love them as much as you want to hate them sometimes. But then I dived into the rest of the album, and I missed Steve. His songwriting still represented, whether that was a similar case to how nice they were with Pete in keeping his legacy intact, I'm not really sure. But there wasn't enough there of him. With Phil handling the guitar duty solo, it loses a certain sound that you expect, that Phil, as good as he is, yeah, he's a bit of a bumblebee to me, but he's a fantastically skilled and gifted player who can run a plethora of genres and styles and make it appropriate. You missed that ping pong of two lead guitarists off one another on the material that would have taken it to a different level. The only song that really stands up for me to this day is White Lightning.
Oh, yeah, that's... And that's not even one of the singles. And that's, to me, that, like, and Tonight are really the key to this album. The deep tracks. I'm going to counter you on this one, because I loved Let's Get Rock, my first turn. I love it to this day. It's a frivolous piece of fun, hard rock. And what's funny about it is that I think it was in Rolling Stone, I read that they said, this song could almost be inspired by Bart Simpson. Guess what, folks? It was inspired by Bart Simpson. The story goes that every night when they were recording this album at 6 o'clock, they would take a dinner break and watch The Simpsons, because over in England, I guess it was shown every night at 6 o'clock or, you know, once a week. And they got inspired by that. They were big fans of the show, and it did inspire the song. So Rolling Stone actually got something right for a change. But yeah, I'll be honest with you. One song that I've never liked and is cringeworthy is the Have You Ever Needed Someone So Bad? No, guys.
See, I like that. You know, while I found there was too much syrupy, they'd kind of gone into Aerosmith, or what Aerosmith's territory of later sins was, in having not enough balance on the hard rocking side, that you've got, you know, Tonight is absolutely glorious. I mean, I actually used to own a DAT of the original demo.
Wow. Nice.
It's a stunning song in the syrupy vein, you know. Have You Ever Needed? Excellent. But there was just too much of the softer kind of middle-of-the-road, boring rock that didn't have the musical fireworks going on. But you know what? Respect to them for even completing it, especially, you know, you get the bonus tracks on the special edition that came out with Miss You in a Heartbeat and She's Too Tough. Those should have been on the, it should have been a 12 song album from the get go with those included. And I can't listen to it without it. They revisit Tear It Down. So there's a lot of revisiting going on in there.
Well, you know, it's interesting that I failed to mention, this is the first album since the High and Dry where Mutt Lange is not involved as the producer. Now, they produced it themselves with Mike Shipley, and Mutt Lange is given a executive producer credit, which, as I understand it, basically he would come in once a week, listen to some songs, give his opinion, and then they did with it what they did with it. Do you know anything about
that? He became the John Kalodner for Def Leppard at that point.
Okay, yeah. I guess he was involved with other things or just didn't have the time for it, but he did consult on it. So there was a bit of that input from him. Obviously a success and kind of the end of an era. Now, when I originally wanted to do the show, I wanted it to be about strictly the 80s, culminating with Hysteria. But then I realized Adrenalize is an 80s album. They started recording in 89. Steve Clark wrote some of the songs. And this album really does – this to me sounds almost like Hysteria Junior or Hysteria Light. It's very similar in the production style, not quite as epic, but it's not that far removed. And, you know, we were talking about the Cars earlier and Mutt Lange. There's a similar analog to this because in 1985, the Cars did a song called Tonight She Comes for their first greatest hits album. The Cars co-produced that with Mike Shipley, who had also worked on Heartbeat City, and they basically replicated the Mutt Lange sound, so much so that when they remastered Heartbeat City a few years ago, they put that on there as a bonus track, and it fits perfectly. So I think they did a good job considering that Mutt Lange was only kind of like a coach, like, you know, like a John Kalodner, like you said. And John Kalodner, by the way, is the guy in the Aerosmith videos who's got the beard and, you know,
and the dress.
And the dress. And he makes a cameo in a lot of their videos because he's probably one of the few A&R guys who's known to rock fans, you know, in that nasal voice and that, you know, it's a fucking masterpiece, Steven, let me tell you.
Yeah, so he's a musical guru.
Yeah, and of course the cover story on Rolling Stone is the four of them, and they mention that they're auditioning the guy from Dio, Vivian Campbell. And of course, you know, they don't do things in a small way. He makes his live debut at the Freddie Mercury tribute in the spring of 92. It's like, man, that had to have been white knuckle for the band and for him, but they pulled it off.
Oh, without a doubt. I was so thrilled when Viv's name gets thrown into the mix. Obviously, having been a fan of Whitesnake, he was in that band for a while. And of course, Dio. Yeah. I thought what we were going to get with Vivian Campbell joining Def Leppard was he was going to bring Dio-like playing, which made me think of Pete Willis, back to Def Leppard. And the next album was going to be High and Dry 2. Oh boy.
Yeah, maybe we'll do that on a future show, but yeah, I know. It's like, but anyway, to wrap this up, we're going to jump forward to 1993 and Def Leppard's very first compilation album, a collection of B-sides, some rare songs called Retroactive. It was released on October 5th, 1993. Julian, what are your thoughts on Retroactive?
Again, I was thrilled when they put this together because as a consumer of B-sides, I liked having quite a lot of the very good ones, you know, cover songs, Action and Only After Dark in one place. And then, of course, we do get a taste of some of the outtakes from the Hysteria Sessions, Desert Song, Fractured Love. You know, it was a nice way to introduce Viv gently, because I think he does a tiny bit of work on the album, but it was nice to compile, you know, another one of my all-time favorite Def Leppard songs appears on this album, and that is From the Inside.
Yeah, this was a really good collection of songs, especially whereas I wasn't as deep a fan as you, so I got to hear some of these outtakes and these rare songs that's like, oh, this is pretty cool. You know, I thought the album cover design was a little ghoulish, in light of, you know, Steve Clark's passing, but I don't know what statement they were making with that. But they kind of had that British sense of humor. Maybe you have some insight into that. I don't know.
That's just Hugh Sim, you know, the Canadian artist who did 2112. He did the babies on Hanging Upside Down on Megadeth's album cover. So again, it's provocative, but again, remember that that album cover could be seen two ways. And I think that's an interesting dichotomy, that they do have kind of the aura of death hanging over them with what had occurred in their lives, just as they have beauty and reflection. So again, a lot of the, I can see why they went with it. If they were presented that idea, here's your album cover or a perspective one, I could see why it might appeal, because it can mean different things in different moments and different perspectives.
Oh yeah. And like I said, it really sums up the classic era nicely. Vivian gets to make a little bit of a debut to kind of tease. We won't get that tease. We're going to get something completely different in 1996, but we'll have to discuss that at a later.
Yeah, but it clears the decks from the 80s, really, by taking a lot of those hysteria B-sides, giving them the moment, closing out Steve Clark's, you know, time with the band. And again, they wrote this product very well. It bought them time for the next project, and they didn't leave much unused, which again was important to me as a music consumer. They were always, you know, throwing out interesting things. I mean, from the inside, a collaboration with Hot House Flowers, a lot of rock fans aren't going to be listening to them, you know, with Irish instrumentation on an album. So again, it was a way for them to be creative and also get that stuff out of there, you know, and rather than languish on B-sides of singles, which everyone and their dog wasn't going to get.
Exactly. Now, Julian, this is the part where I ask you what you're working on, but I know what you're working on. So I guess I'm going to be a little more direct and say, how is Aerosmith on Tour Volume 2 coming along?
Yeah, it's coming along. I'd hope to have the Get a Grip article, or what will be the narrative that appears in the book, done in order to have that out as a sample of where I'm going with this volume, because it's not going to be done identically to Volume 1. So Volume 2, I'm hoping to have out later this year. It picks up the history of the touring side of Aerosmith, on the Done With Mirrors tour, which was originally cut from the first volume, and goes up through, I think I wrote through 2007 and had to chop some chapters off. So I don't know where it ends yet, but we'll certainly get up to the Kiss tour and probably the Cheap Trick one in 2004 as well. I want to wrap up all the studio albums that actually matter. So Honking on Bobo is a good stopping point, because after that, it all becomes a little bit overly dramatic and less dynamic. There's less aerodynamics involved in the music that's released afterwards.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah. I, as far as I'm concerned, you're picking a good cutoff point.
Well, it's just like the first album was about Columbia and David Krebs and Steve Lieber and John O'Toole and, you know, all of the original managers and backers of the band. It's nice to encapsulate this one generally as the Geffen years.
Yeah.
Because, again, those are the years that are most important to most people who were of the MTV generation. Once you get back with the reunification of the catalog and the Sony deal, you know, I love Nine Lives and Just Push Play has grown on me. But, you know, they're less important. So I'm trimming off everything that gets anywhere near Guitar Hero and American Idol.
Wise choice, because it just becomes more about the behind the scenes drama than anything musical.
Well, it also becomes a greatest hits tour, a legacy tour tour after tour. I'm not saying they're not good tours. I'm not saying there's not some interesting music. They remained a powerful band. And there is a third volume there. Whether I do it is a different matter. But again, there's so much more music of interest to talk about in Volume 2.
Absolutely. And as a longtime Aerosmith fan, I know I said this last time, but I just want to reiterate, I've been an Aerosmith fan since 78. My only problem with Volume 1 is when I finished it, it's like, okay, I'm ready for the next one. Oh, it's not coming for another year or two. Oh, crap. It's that good, folks. I'm not just saying this because Julian's on my show. I would recommend this to anybody who's an Aerosmith fan, because it's just a treasure trove of information. Brought back a lot of memories, all good. And so I guess I'll say, Julian, where are you on the internet and where can the listeners find you?
Well, people can generally just find me at kissfaq.com. We post all our shows, whether it's the Look It's Rock and Roll podcast or the Kiss FAQ podcast there. I am on Facebook as well under my name, and you'll probably see some mutual friends in order to find me. But that's, you know, everything basically happens for me over at the FAQ.
Yes, and you did speak of doing an Aerosmith podcast, which I mentioned earlier, called Sick as a Pot. Is that going any place yet, or is it still kind of in the early stages?
I'm conceptualizing where I want to go with it and how I want to make it different from the things that I do with
Okay.
other podcasts. It needs to have value. I'm not entirely sure. It will be sick ass podcast, sick as a pod. I definitely want to talk Aerosmith and go kind of deep. I want it to be a combination of, say, the sort of things that Brad Page does with I'm in Love with That Song, of diving deep into a particular song rather than just ranking an album of what is your favorite. So I want to find people who can speak musically as guitar players or bass players or drummers. On that side of things, and marry it with my consumer point of view and my tertiary knowledge of the business. So what it ends up being, has to be something of value, because there are a lot of voices out there I've met as a result of the Aerosmith book who I think have stories that other people will enjoy hearing, or hearing them discuss.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, and I do hope that when you're considering potential guests, that you'll put me on the docket, because I would love to be a part of it. If only for an episode or two, but we'll see what happens with that. Julian,
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it. More than likely going to have a rotating cast of people who come in for
exactly.
specific topics.
Let's not let another year go by before we podcast again, my friend, because I always enjoy talking to you, whether it be Aerosmith, Def Leppard, and whatever else we talk about the next go around.
Well, likewise, and it's been great to relive some very special years of my life enjoying these Def Leppard albums. And you know what? I think I'm going to go back and listen to High and Dry again today.
You know what? I might just follow suit. And with that, we end this episode of Mr. K's Super Show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to Mr. K's Super Show. If you like what you heard, please write a review on Apple Podcasts and share it on Facebook, Twitter, or whatever social media you like. Thank you for listening to Mr. K's Super Show.
Thank you.